One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Well, I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 7th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the five economic reforms for millennials to fight for. Jesse Meyerson will be here to talk about his Rolling Stone piece, which is freaking out conservatives and, frankly, some centrists. Also on the program today, unemployment benefits extension passes its first hurdle unexpectedly. Supreme Court stays a measure allowing for marriage equality in Utah. Janet Yellen, the new Fed chief, and healthcare costs as a function of the GDP, and I guess overall, their rate of growth has shrunk. For what it's worth, and the sad story of the ethically and follically challenged Frank Luntz. All that and more on today's program.
I look forward to that one.
Yeah.
Basically just challenged at this point.
Yeah.
The man's got
You know, it's hard not to feel bad for the guy. Actually, no, it's hard to feel bad for the guy. That's what I meant to say. I'm sorry.
The folks are kind of Dick Cheney-like response.
Yeah, I wouldn't call him Dick Cheney, but he's...
No, I'm just saying, like, lack of empathy.
Yeah.
Lack of caring.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to do a focused group on that and see. just in, and a little bit surprising, by a vote of 60-37... There was essentially what was a procedural vote, I believe, in the Senate. But it is indicative of where the Senate is on this. To extend unemployment benefits for long-term unemployed by 3 months. It was a bill that was authored by Senator Dean Heller from Nevada, Republican, and Senator Jack Reed from Rhode Island. They both come from states with about 9% unemployment. And surprisingly, they got the 60 vote threshold to move the bill forward. Joining Heller was Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, Susan Collins in Maine, and then Senator Dan Coats in Indiana and Rob Portman from Ohio. Apparently, Portman must know someone who's unemployed and therefore decided to vote for an extension. There's been a lot of speculation as to why the Republicans are not voting for this. Some people think they're just... psychopaths, I mean, just sort of sociopaths, I should say, without any caring for those who have been unemployed and continue to seek work even though there are four applicants for every one job in this country. It will add about $6 billion to the deficit. The argument that this adds for the deficit, that it needs to be paid for, is, of course, ridiculous. The deficit is dropping at an unprecedented rate. It has dropped at an unprecedented rate. It is not even half of what it was when President Obama came into office. We know that unemployment benefits helps the economy in addition to helping those individuals who receive it. And we know that as the economy grows, the deficit shrinks because revenues go up. So it not only helps those who are unemployed, but it puts more money back into the economy. Therefore, more people can pay more taxes. Therefore, the deficit shrinks. There's a multiplier effect of something like 1.7 for this these unemployment benefits. It's considered one of the best economic stimulus that there are. So there are no arguments other than, and some are speculating, that this is simply out-and-out sabotage of the economy going into the 2014 elections. I wouldn't put it past them. Now, this will have to go to the House, where John Boehner is probably in no mood to help the economy or those who are long-term unemployed. And then, of course, it would come back to the Senate and conference. But we will see. But it is a surprising vote, and at least it puts pressure on those in the House. Republicans are claiming this is just a political ploy to distract from probably the plight of the unemployed by actually helping the unemployed. I don't know how that logic works, but
that's like literally swooping into a soup kitchen and snatching food from people and being like, I don't want to distract from your plight.
Yes, exactly. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jesse Meyerson. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Jesse Meyerson. He is a writer. His piece is at Rolling Stone, 5 Economic Reforms for Millennials to Fight For. And he's also the co-host of Disorderly Conduct, a radical economics and finance podcast, which I can't remember. I guess I listened to an episode. Maybe it was the second or third episode. It was sometime before the new year. But Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Sam.
So you've got a great piece. I mean, I love this piece in that you've written in Rolling Stone for a number of reasons. But it certainly got people talking, both on the right and within sort of the center left and left circles. Five economic reforms for millennials should be fighting for. Let's just start. Why millennials?
Well, I think there's very little hope of getting much by way of like transformative economic change out of the current system. And any of these proposals will take a struggle of like 15 to 20 years to fight for. So by that time, the people who are now millennials, which is actually a term I can't stand, will be the group constituting the sort of politically dominant age group. So I think that we have to start fighting for these things now, and millennials as a group that are especially hard hit by the post-2008 economic situation are probably more receptive to ideas that question the essential wisdom of market capitalism than previous generations who have memories of the anxiety over thermonuclear annihilation and who were sort of inculcated with a fear of gulags and stuff. We don't really have that because we were basically born after the Soviet era. So we're sort of unencumbered by the various social forces that meant that people wouldn't question the wisdom of capitalism. And so I think that it's a group. I mean, you know, the other thing is that I am myself a millennial and I'm pretty good at talking to people my age about economics. So for those reasons, I felt like addressing it to millennials. But I've written about these ideas in different forums for different audiences as well.
Yeah, so I mean, so we should be looking at this as a way of starting to introduce certain policy ideas to the generation that's going to have to clean up this mess that apparently nobody in the present establishment has really, it seems to me, a significant interest in doing so. All right, so let's go through these, and we should say these are not. You know, it is completely freaked out people on the right. But these are not ideas that are really, frankly, too far fetched. We see at least concrete examples of I think at least four of your proposals in various places around the world, including the United States. But let's start with number one, guaranteed work for everybody. What?
Yeah, so. The usual way that the federal government tries to stimulate employment is by doing what they call stimulus. And basically what that looks like conventionally is they give money to firms in the hope that the economic growth that the money they give to firms creates will sort of trickle down to everybody and will create employment and firms will start hiring. But the problem with that is that usually what happens is the firms hire the most hireable people, which is to say people who already have jobs or people who've recently had jobs. And conventional stimulus rarely trickles all the way down to the people who need it most, which is to say the long-term unemployed, the intergenerationally impoverished, the recently incarcerated, these groups of people. So I call this the Drake principle of stimulus, which is that you want to start from the bottom if you want your whole team to be here. And so the purpose of the job guarantee is to just make, to rather than hoping that growth will produce jobs, just giving everybody a job and letting that produce growth.
Now, you made the point of, first off, we've seen something like this, at least in the context of the Great Depression with the WPA, the Work Progress Administration. This is also something that you mention, and it's particularly relevant because in some levels, you know, we were recently talking about the whitewashing of Martin Luther King and of Nelson Mandela's legacy. This is something that Martin Luther King supported back in the 1960s. And we should also note the other benefit of something like this, whereas you see the stimulus that in the form of, like, say, corporate tax breaks or enterprise zones or those are not targeted at jobs necessarily that also can contribute to the infrastructure, whether it is a human or infrastructure capital of the country. I mean, because in this instance, when you're talking about a program like this, we're talking teachers, we're talking about social workers, we could be talking about building trains, whatever, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So obviously there's lots of infrastructure work that needs doing, bullet trains, the national fiber optics telecommunications infrastructure, what else? A clean energy infrastructure. There's lots of building that needs to get done, and that's the private sector is just not going to do that. That's got to be done by the public sector. But it's sort of clumsy to have a permanent jobs program that's just building stuff. I mean, we see in China, they just basically build and build and build, and it doesn't produce the most socially equitable results. Rather, I like an economist named Pavlina Chernova, who teaches at Bard College, where incidentally I went. I did not study economics there. But her proposal is to run a job guarantee through the nonprofit sector, which would essentially allow nonprofits who are already doing valuable community work and would be doing more of it, except that they lack funds, to do more of it and to hire more people. And you could even have sort of the equivalent of a public interest like fellowship, where basically people could, if you could identify a need in the community and draw up a proposal for how to meet it, out detailing how many jobs would be created in the process, then you could basically obtain funding for it. And it would really target money into providing jobs for people who are doing the most valuable work in the community, whether that is being a community historian and documenting the stories of old folks, or being a companion to the infirm, or painting murals, or any number of things that communities would really benefit from and would make life really good in the United States.
And of course, the multiplier effect on that painting murals would mean that governors in Maine would have the opportunity to tear them down all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
We should also say that you're suggesting this would also function as what is known as an automatic stabilizer. Just tell us about that part of it.
Yeah. So if we can just guarantee everybody a job, it means that when the business cycle comes around and crashes for whatever reason, people aren't thrust into unemployment. They're just thrust into a different job. So the job program necessarily increases its spending when the private sector is in a downturn, and then decreases its spending when the business cycle picks back up again. So that, combined with the fact that it would pay a base wage that would be the base wage for the entire economy, I propose it to be a living wage with all the basic benefits. Those two things acting together create a really powerful price anchor, which means that despite the large fiscal expenditure that it would entail, prices would not go up. Inflation, in other words, would not happen. And inflation is the only limit on a deficit.
And we should say, you know, this automatic stabilizers, we see them all the time. They've been very effective in at least mitigating some of the impact of this current Great Recession. Unemployment benefits is one of those automatic stabilizers. Food stamps, an automatic stabilizer. So now let's get to your next proposal, which this we see examples on some level or some variant of it in existence now. You say Social Security for all, what is known as a universal basic income. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I think that this proposal works best when coupled with a job guarantee. I know that it's pretty fashionable, especially for socialists. I know that this is a big proposal that is often bandied about in the pages of Jacobin magazine. But the goal for socialists is to relieve people of the necessity of having to work, since work is alienating and exploitative and all that kind of stuff. But I think that coupled with a job guarantee, it would be a really good idea because it retains the price anchor of the job guarantee. It just makes it so that employment is truly voluntary. The thing that we have to realize is that basically everybody's working all the time. There's lots of work that discloses itself as natural and not externally imposed, like child rearing and domestic work, usually the sorts of things that are foisted on women who are not compensated for their labor. So universal basic income is a way of acknowledging that there are many forms of work that are not considered work by the vast majority of people, and that people ought to be compensated for them anyway. So that you could go into a job guarantee job, take it for a while, leave, go into a private sector job when the business cycle came around, leave, raise a child, and never have to worry that you're going to starve or be kicked out of your home. So that the two things taken together, a job guarantee with a universal basic income, I think fixes a lot of the labor problems we have.
How do we pay for that? How is it possible to pay for that, to give everybody a some type of guaranteed minimum basic income?
Well, you know, the federal government does all of its spending only one way, which is it simply increases the balances of bank accounts at a keystroke. It's the same way it taxes, which is just decreasing the balances of bank accounts. So finding the money for it, in other words, is not hard. We can create unlimited money. Money is just a way of mobilizing resources, right? So if we can marshal the resources required to, say, provide everyone with a dignified life, doing meaningful things that fulfill them, then we can definitely afford the money to make that happen, because the money is infinite. We can never run out of it. We don't have to store any of it up. We can just create it as needed. It's a public monopoly. If you notice, any dollar bill has a signature of a Treasury Secretary. So as long as it's a public monopoly, it should be put toward the public purpose.
And we should say, you know, Dylan Matthews wrote a sort of a, I guess, a companion piece over at Wonk Blog from a conservative perspective. And he, from a conservative perspective, this would simply be, I guess, sort of framed as, you know, no more government handouts, no more sort of crazy bureaucracies for different forms of welfare and government assistance. It's just simplify things, just give people money, essentially. And he notes that there were several, including Milton Friedman, conservative economists who have proposed such a system. All right, let's.
They call it a negative income tax. Just to make it clear, I don't think that it could replace the entirety of the social welfare state. Matt Brunig, who's a blogger at Demos, has a wonderful piece about a sort of tiered universal basic income system where mothers or parents, I guess, would get an additional universal basic income. We would keep around disability pay and things like that. But a universal basic income could definitely replace lots and lots of different programs.
I love it. I like that thing about the parents, too. I mean, good. All right. Let's go to number three. This is something I'm not terribly familiar with, a land value tax. Explain to us what this is.
Yeah. So the guy who made this famous was an economist named Henry George. And it's actually the principle that the board game Monopoly is based on, which is to say that when there's private ownership of land value, and by land, I don't just mean the land, although I do mean that. I also mean the minerals and oil and all of the things that nature provides that human beings didn't create, you know, not buildings and stuff, which people made, but just the natural resources. The fact that we let people pretend to own the things that they didn't make, that nobody made, that nature made, necessarily results in great poverty for some people and the consolidation of most of the property into a single trust. That's what happens in Monopoly. By the end, everybody's bankrupt except one person who has all of the resources. So a land value tax is just a way of taking that value and giving it to the people who actually make the land valuable, which is everybody, because my landlord doesn't actually make the land valuable. The reason that I pay so much freaking rent in Manhattan to live in my apartment is because it's near parks, which the city provides, it's near subways, which the state provides, it's near a bunch of great shops and Dominican food, which the community provides, and so really it's everybody else who's not my landlord who should be deriving the value of the land. The flip, which is the main urban real estate move that they do, goes like this. A property developer will take out a bunch of money from the bank, and in order to pay the bank the interest, they'll send to the bank the full rental value of the property. So they don't, the landlord doesn't actually get the rent. They just send that to the banks. What they get is after 5 years, let's say, of owning a building, they flip it, which is to say they sell it to a different landlord, and they just make off with the appreciated value of the land beneath it, which is called a capital gain. And that doesn't even get taxed if they just plow it into buying more and more real estate. So currently, the tax code, which it incentivizes the accumulation of big real estate fortunes, and by taxing labor and industry, also incentivizes things like offshoring and all sorts of other bad practices. If we flipped the way that we did the tax system, we could have a single, Henry George proposed a single tax on natural resources, and in so doing, you could eliminate literally all other taxes. No sales tax, no income tax, no payroll tax, none of those taxes, just one tax on the people who own the natural resources. And if you look at it, you'll find that the people who own the natural resources are basically the 1%.
And so this would be an annual tax on the value of just the land, not necessarily the buildings on it.
Yes, right. So people already get property taxes, right? But and this is also a conservative idea. The Economist has argued for it really well. They have an article called "Levying the Land" that I would urge people to look up. It's a much less disruptive tax to tax the value of the land, since the land is a fixed quantity. You can't build any more of it, except in, as Dylan notes, in Dubai, where they build weird islands in various shapes. But basically, you can't. That's why Manhattan real estate is so valuable, because there's very, very little land. It's the one thing that's really scarce in Manhattan. And so there's high demand for it, and it's scarce. So if you tax that and bring the value of property down to its actual cost of production, then you eliminate the problems. Like, for instance, the housing bubble would never have happened because, as Arrested Development made clear, all of these McMansions that were going up in these residential developments were basically crap. They were falling apart. They were like shoddy workmanship, terrible materials. And the reason that they were so valuable was that the speculative commodity that speculators were bidding up and up and up was the value of the land beneath it. So if that value had been taxed and all that the people who were buying new properties owned was the crappy materials that made up the actual house, the speculative bubble would never have happened.
And so what does this do? I mean, is this in your mind imposed by the federal government? What does it do to sort of the revenue that municipalities, that towns get from property taxes as we know it now?
There's some debate over whether it would be constitutional, whether it's a direct tax, and whether it could be done at a federal level. I actually don't think it would need to be done at a federal level because most land is not very expensive. I think that really where it should be done is places like San Francisco and New York, places where land is extremely scarce and extremely valuable and where prices just go up and up and up, which forces working class and poor people to leave their communities. It shreds communities apart. So I think the best place to impose a land value tax would be in individual cities. But you could do it federally. There's a blogger named, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Ashok Rao, A-S-H-O-K, last name R-A-O, who is an extremely impressive 18-year-old freshman at UPenn who writes really, really eloquently about this. So if people are interested in land value tax, they ought to look up Ashok Rao.
And we should say that there are examples already in this country. In Pennsylvania, I think, is one of those states where there's a bunch of towns that already do this.
Yep, absolutely. That and we ought to note that a universal basic income is already happening in Alaska, which we'll get to, I guess, in the next one. But all of these proposals, except the first one, already happen in the United States, and the first one is enshrined in the Indian Constitution. So none of these is outlandish. They're all extant, viable options.
All right, let's get to the idea of a sovereign wealth fund, your fourth idea. What... tell us what that means.
So this, I'll just talk about the Alaska Permanent Fund because it's a really good, vivid illustration. Basically, way back when Alaska was starting out, which I guess was in the 40s, they had a bunch of oil revenue and they didn't have a lot of people, so they didn't need to tax a lot. So they had all this surplus, and the way that they decided to distribute it was just to put it into an investment fund that is owned, I'm putting air quotes up that you can't see, owned by the state of Alaska, but it doesn't really do it. There's not really a bureaucracy. It just buys up assets, just like any investment fund would do, a hedge fund, a pension fund, whatever. It buys up assets, and whatever the dividends are, it just pays out to everybody. So everybody in Alaska gets a universal basic income. It's not sufficient for subsistence. It's like $1,000 a year or something like that. But it's just a dividend from this public investment fund. And so that's what a sovereign wealth fund is. It's just a way of taking one of the big drivers of inequality is the fact that financial wealth is owned by such a small percentage of people. 80% of financial wealth in this country is owned by the top 10%. So they just suck up all of the dividends, all of the capital gains, all of the all of this passive money. This would just be a way of directing all of that money to everybody. Because the shareholders in the corporation, by and large, aren't the people actually managing the corporation. They're sort of passive. They sit by the pool with their insipid martinis, and they wait for the butler to bring over one of those silver tray things that has their check on it for all of the hard work they did. They didn't do any hard work. That was us. So it's just a way of collectivizing ownership claims on the capital stock of the country. But it doesn't actually affect the businesses, because the owners of businesses, by and large, aren't the ones managing them.
All right, great. And so let's go to your fifth proposal. This is a public bank in every state. This is something that we hear a lot of talk about, because there's already been one. Well, there's been one, I guess, in North Dakota for 70, 80 years now.
And when it was set up, it was set up by people who had a socialist bent, and they encountered lots and lots of resistance. But since it's been up, it's been really good for the state of North Dakota, and it actually helped them weather the economic storm of 2008 better than most other states, especially most other states in the upper Midwest region. It just seems like such a good idea to have a public option for banking, so that people don't have to do all of their finance through Wall Street. The other thing that you can do, that there's a really good proposal out, would be to have some sort of basic banking services through the U.S. Postal Service, which would provide a new revenue stream for the Postal Service, which, as we've seen, has had some difficulty basically foisted on it by Republicans in Congress. But it would help them out with that. It would allow the so-called underbanked to have some access to financial services, and it would just give people a point of exit. People who don't want to do crazy, you know, derivative speculation, all that kind of nutty stuff that goes on Wall Street, who just want a safe place to store their money, an easy payment system, and a little bit of interest on their savings. You could do it in a public bank. The Public Bank of North Dakota just loans out, you know, works with, you know, farmers and students and people who take out loans, works to get the money back. All of the tax dollars in North Dakota go straight into the bank. The bank deals with all of the infrastructure. It's such a sensible idea. It's so basic and obvious that it should just be in every state. This is one I think that probably we have a chance of doing before 15 to 20 years in certain states. I feel like maybe there are 15 states who over the next 10 years could, with some significant activism, actually adopt establish a new public bank.
And what does this do? I mean, is this basically just it sort of rationalizes and stabilizes sort of the it just gets banking back to, I guess, vanilla banking on some level, right? I mean, where.
Yeah, that's right.
So the benefits to the state in and of itself are simply that people will have a consistent access to loans based on fairly consistent and rational standards, ones that aren't necessarily subject to an algorithm that has to go into a larger tranche of securities, right? I mean, what it does to the community?
That's exactly right. Okay. That's exactly right. Ellen Brown, who's sort of the leader, so to speak, of the public banking movement, is somebody people should look up. I think she's running for attorney general in California or something. But if you look up Ellen Brown, you'll find lots and lots of really good resources on public banking and the ways that it could be implemented.
All right. Well, Jesse, I know you got to run, but I appreciate your taking the time today. The piece is in Rolling Stone. It is 5 economic reforms millennials should be fighting for. And you know, maybe some of us, you know, Gen Xer types also.
That would be good. We could use the help.
Sure. Why not? I have little memory of the gulags, I have to say. But sadly, I do remember Reagan quite well. Jesse Meyerson, thank you so much. We'll put a link up to Disorderly Conduct on the blog at majority.fm. Appreciate your time today.
Terrific. Thanks so much, Sam. Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks. It's about that time. Yeah, why not? I'm going to head into the funner half.
Freebies have been getting so much bonus free material. I think it's time we end the free show on time.
Yeah. Man. It's like not even, it's like uber freebie for you guys. In the funner half of the program, we may do a random rush which we have not done, in 2014, our first 2014 version of Random Rush. And then I guess we have some stories that aren't so fun, but then we'll also have the Frank Luntz story. And also, I want to we're going to link to this on the blog at majority.fm. Maybe down the road we will get the author of this book, which has which essentially has provided these revelations. But you'll recall we've been talking quite a bit about the church committee hearings, and much of the church committee hearings were based on a trove of stolen documents that made their way to, I guess, the Washington Post and I believe the New York Times, which one of the biggest revelations was the existence of COINTELPRO, which was an FBI program to basically spy on any type of left-wing dissent in this country. There's a piece in the New York Times today by Mark Mazzetti, which, like I say, is a function of a book that is being written by Betty Metzger. She was a former reporter for the Washington Post, who was one of the first recipients of these documents. And it, the book, I guess, and this piece in the Times reveals for the first time the group of, I guess it was eight people who participated in the burglary of these documents and until now have been, I guess, unknown. And they include a couple of professors, one of religion, I think, the other of, I mean, these are people, one guy was a professor of religion at Temple University. Another was a, I think, a professor at Swarthmore, or no, I'm sorry, a physics professor at Haverford. These were anti-war protesters who felt that their protesting was simply not going far enough. And they spent months staking out a satellite FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and basically broke in, stole these documents, sent them to reporters, and stayed unknown for years. The statute of limitations passed in 1976. Apparently the FBI had no idea who these people were. I think one of the people involved was on a list of suspects, but they couldn't really approve anything. And now these people, at least five of the eight, have revealed themselves in the course of being written about in this book. So when the day comes, we will get the author on this program. But in the meantime, you should check out this piece in the New York Times. It's a fascinating story. And I think in part, at least some of them seem to be motivated to come out because of their sympathies for Edward Snowden. So it's a fascinating piece I wanted to direct you to. And I should also remind you that you can support this program by becoming a member today at majority.fm. Folks, don't you want to be able to say that you are the engine? Maybe no, the fuel that feeds the engine of the three-time news and politics award-winning political podcast, The Majority Report. Or don't you just want to support the program because you listen to it every day? But either way, become a member today if you have the financial means to do so. Also, if you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link. Go to MajorityReportKickback.com. MajorityReportKickback.com. Just do it now. It's super easy. If you're on your computer, MajorityReportKickback.com. Bookmark that link. Whenever you buy your crap through Amazon, buy it through that link. And we get a kickback. And you can also do it through the app. There's a button on the page, support the show. You can buy, if you buy stuff through Amazon, just on your phone, I guess, do it there. I don't know if people do that. And, well, I want to double check with this guy that the offer's there. But you can also get the app at majorityapp.com. Give us a review on iTunes. What else? JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate.
Subscribe to us at all the different channels.
Yes, YouTube and on iTunes and pass around. The app is free, so anybody you should know. I mean, that's what you should be doing.
Yes.
Once a week or twice a week, you should be telling a coworker or a family member, get this app. It's free, and there's all sorts of content there for you.
Go to your local cell phone store and download the app on all the different model devices.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, the different, the ones that people use when you're at the AT&T store, Sprint store, whatever store.
Oh, I love that.
Do that. That'd be pretty cool.
That's a...
And even leave the app open.
That's a marketing a hack. Nice. I love it. So get on that today, folks. Really appreciate it. 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of the program. Just Coffee, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. I think I mentioned that. 10% coupon code, Majority. Good stuff there. See you in the better half.